Okay. So I thought when I arrived, and there weren't many people here, that maybe people saw the topic for this morning and thought, I think I'll stay home. But yeah, most of you, you have toddled out of bed and are here, so that's it's lovely to have some people to talk to. Right, I'm going to read you a poem. It's called The End. When I was one, I had just begun. When I was two, I was nearly new. When I was three, I was hardly me. When I was four, I was not much more. When I was five, I was just alive. But now I am six. I am clever as clever. So I think I'll be six now, forever and ever. We live our lives in the framework of time. I was just thinking yesterday, it popped into my mind, this will be the third time I've talked about time at church, so it's obviously a bit of a thing that I think about a lot. And today what I want to do is look at us and our lives in the framework of walking through time with God. And look at what that means in terms of our changing relationships, the changing nature of the relationships we have with people as we share our timeline with their timeline. It sounds awfully linear, and I'm not normally a linear sort of person, but I think it serves a purpose. I've also invited three people to share a little bit as part of what I'm talking about this morning. So I'm going to keep my bit fairly short, hopefully, I'll try. Where's the clock? There it is. And then ask three people to say something a little bit. And then after that, either break into big groups or we can have a vote. We can either stay as one big group or break into groups. So the reason I came to this topic today, it's been on my mind for about a year that, and I've talked to the people who organize the speakers' rosters, and they were keen for me to do something about this topic. I noticed when it went out on the email, Trish had titled it with the thing that I was thinking about a year ago, but it's kind of evolved a little bit from that, but that's all right. What I had noticed in our community and for myself was that a lot of us are in a changing relationship with people who are getting quite a bit older, and a lot of people have had complex and challenging times in terms of looking after people towards the end of their lives. And when I think about that, I think about what are their changing needs, how do we look after those people? But I also think about two things in relation to ourselves. One is, as we see people ahead of us aging, what does it bring up for ourselves as we age, thinking, oh, that's where I'm heading, that's going to be me one day. And what is the changing nature of our relationship with other people as we move into a position where we're caring more for them? And what does it ask of us? And what does that mean for us? So children in our little poem know that they're moving along a timeline. They have quite a big sense of I'm getting bigger. And society celebrates that. You know, it's something to rejoice. You have a birthday and you're bigger now and you can do more. So you start off in this little life and you're dependent on other people and they care for you. But you start pushing against that pretty quickly, like 18 months, or is it earlier than that? Some babies very, very early, sort of pushing against, going, oh, I'm not just being looked after, I've also got a life of my own. So we're going along our timeline and we're experiencing the push-me-pull-you between our timeline and the people around us right from the beginning, and that growing sense of exploration and discovery and growing into our power of who am I, and who am I in relation to you. When I was about, I don't know, it would have been about 9 or 10, my parents somehow acquired a set of encyclopedias. and I can't remember which ones they were, but they filled the bottom shelf of a bookcase. And I remember reading, thinking, I'll just start at the beginning, I'll read the lot. By the time I've read all these, I will know everything. And I had this tremendous sense of, you know, that it was just there waiting for me, that I could explore that, and I could have a handle on all this stuff, and all I had to do was read that set of books. I don't know how far I got. I can't remember past the thought. But I had a similar experience when I got to about 18 and, you know, finishing school and leaving that environment, and that sense of the future opening out and anything was possible. Not only could I do anything, I could be anything. That I thought I had complete control of my character. Well, that didn't work too well. What I didn't realise, and I think it's a protective thing, you know, when you're young, if you know how complex life's going to be in the future, perhaps you wouldn't want to go there. But that sense that, but it was my agency, that sense of agency. And so my sense of the people around me is that they were no longer responsible for me, and I didn't have any great sense of responsibility for them. I wasn't in the situation of some young people who, you know, are carers from quite a young age. So I just went and did my own thing. And then as you go on, you become responsible for other people in lots of different ways, in your work situation, if you're a parent, your children or your other young people in your life, your spouse, if you have a spouse, your friends who have varying and changing needs. But then you reach another stage where people who used to care for you, suddenly you need to be caring for them. And this calls forth another whole set of things which is complex and difficult. And what I noticed in our community as I talked to individuals and heard people's stories is that as people are moving into that part of life, and some, you know, further than others, that this has been a very significant change. And I've seen people dealing with really hard things. And quite often, if I've asked people, well, how are you going with that? This is my reading of it, and it may not be accurate. I felt that what people are saying is, it's hard, but I'm managing. You know, it's just what the situation is, it's what I need to do. But, you know, not unwilling to share some of the difficulty of it, but it seemed to me a very, in some ways, a little bit of an isolating experience, that while we can share some of it with other people, it's if that's what we're called upon to do, then it's, you know, just pick yourself up by your bootstraps and on you go. And so the question came to me of how do we care for one another when we're experiencing these changing calls on our life. I was going to draw something.
So this is me. I could do it as Venn diagrams, but it gets awfully messy, so I'm just going to do it as a line. That's my mum.
My dude.
Dad. There are my kids. So obviously I could have all my friends on there and everybody I've ever met, but I'm just picking a few to start with. So what I'm interested in is
these relationships. And the changes that happen all the way along, they're not all of a sort, they don't go along a preset plan, but there are things that sort of stick out in your mind as moments where you think. And I remember the moment when, because I live in Perth and my mother lives in Sydney, my seeing my mum, you know, a lot of the care that I do is via my sisters and over the phone, but then I go and visit and I see her. And I remember a day about here where I looked at my mum and I thought, the time has come for a change in our relationship. It's no longer my role in my relationship with my mother to correct her. It's no longer my role to set her right or to challenge her or to push against who she is. She doesn't need that from me. It's no use to her, and it's only causing me frustration. So I put that aside, and it was a wonderful thing. It felt like, you know, a loss in a way, like I have to contain myself and be good now. But it was a wonderful thing. So I'll come back to that. I wonder when you watched the clip of Mother and Son, and we talked to the kids a little bit about that, who you identified with in that. As Lee said, I found it so embarrassing when I first saw that. I couldn't watch it for years. It was just... But gradually I came to love that show for its rawness and for the gentle way it deals with things that are uncomfortable. And anyway, so that's a different thing. Don't know if anyone wants to say anything about Mother and Son that you comes up for you, or you can just sit with it.
Frustration I had, and I was obviously 30 years younger when it was on TV, but the frustration I had was that Arthur was just wasting his life. Mm. That's what it felt like for me as a young man watching it.
Mm. Yeah. I'm going to jump to one bit that's further down because I want to then, you know, I want to leave plenty of room for other people. But this book's been on my shelf since 80s, is it? Something like that. 90s, okay. 83 or 80, yep. Yeah. There's a chapter in here which I'd never read because I didn't like the title. It's called Submission. So I'm sure you can identify with that. Oh, it's for the tape. It's Celebration of Discipline by Richard Foster. And so his chapter on submission. Yeah, when I read it, it's a fantastic chapter. So I thought, oh, okay, maybe I'm ready for this now. But he talks about submission as the ability to lay aside your right to have your own way. And, you know, this whole question of caring for others, I mean, obviously it doesn't just apply to older people, but I think this, you know, in this situation where we're thinking about Arthur in this film clip, sometimes we voluntarily take up a role and sometimes we just find ourselves there. And so it's not always something we've been invited into and we've said yes to. Sometimes it's just what happened. And so I guess that's one of these tensions that across the generations that I have been thinking about and feeling that I want to explore a little bit is, how do we go with that, what we have agreed to and the contract we've entered into with ourselves, and what we just have to do because that's where we've landed. And our culture is also quite complex here because, you know, we don't live in a culture that really values people in their frailty. We live in a culture that, yep, doesn't include them in the stories on TV, and we externalise, you know, once old people lived at home and were cared for often by the women in the house, but not exclusively. Yeah, so that if what society values is coming into your power and being autonomous and being able to explore the world and do the things you want to do, you can do anything. What does it mean when suddenly not only were our children dependent on us, but now other people are dependent? It could be a spouse or it could be a parent or it could be a friend. People are dependent on us and we have to, or we choose to, put to one side the things that perhaps we wanted to do. One of the phrases, I'll paraphrase it because it's better than me trying to find it, that Richard Foster uses is that he said, we've learned only to be happy if we can get our own way. And he talks about people, he says, people spend weeks, even months or years in a perpetual stew because some little thing did not go as they wished. They will, I'm sure he should say we, of course, he should include himself. We will fuss and fume and get mad about it, that we will act as if our very life hangs on the issue, and they may even get an ulcer over it. So he says, in every discipline there's a corresponding freedom. It is the ability to lay down a terrible burden of always needing to get our own way, the obsession to demand that things go the way we want them to go is one of the greatest bondages in human society today. And when I read, you know, this is the conversation I have with Peter, what do we use a book for? And I use it to argue with. So when you hear that, what happens inside? Do you go, oh yeah, that's where I want to go, or stuff that? You know, what's your response when you hear him say something like that? Like, how would he know? You know, that's a very bold statement to make, that this is the way of freedom. So, yes, later on when we break up into groups, that might be one of the things that people might like to talk about. I've got far too much stuff and some other readings and things, but I did just want to mention Jesus, because this is church. And, you know... Yeah, as Lee said in introducing the song, we see Jesus walk that path as a dependent child, and we see him when he's 12 in the temple going, no, I've got to take up my life, I've got to live it now, and saying to his mother, I'm not here to be your child now, I'm going out into the world to do my thing. And there's a point where he actually says, he sends his mother away and says, no, this is my family, this is what I've got to do. You're almost irrelevant to me at this point. And then lastly, we see Jesus on the cross, and he's one of his last things he thinks about is who is going to care for his mother. And he turns to John and says, behold your mother, and to Mary, his mother, behold your son. So Jesus himself walked that changing relationship with people around him, and he shares that with us. Anyway, I've invited three people to come and say something, and please don't feel, oh no, what I'm saying doesn't seem to match anything that Jenny has said. It'll all go into the patchwork. So Lyndon, would you like to go first?
I resonate with a lot of what you said, Jen. So up until last year, Michael and I, between us, we're caring for three elderly parents. We're down to one this year. I guess that's one of the things about that, do know that it has a finite point. For me, I'm just going to share personally some of the things that it brought up for me, but it actually has taken me back to the time when I had toddlers at home. And the analogy is, I guess, that you love them dearly and they frustrate the heck out of you at times, and it's exhausting and it's never fair. You can't say, it's my turn now, it's not fair. That's just not how it goes. You've got to go with the need. And for me, when I first became a mother, the most shattering thing was to have revealed to me how incredibly selfish and self-centred I still was, despite great spiritual enlightenment. And I guess you like to think that over the years that you will become more spiritually enlightened and be able to handle some of these things, but I actually feel like really sometimes strangling my mother. I can just get so frustrated. There's no one who knows how to press your buttons in the same way as close family, whether it's your kids or your parents. So for me, it's been coming face to face with yet again having to learn what is deeply inside me that needs God's redemptive touch. And I guess the other thing is to say that I couldn't do it alone. To have had Rose and Irene and Jen each fortnight listen to me probably say the same thing over and over again. But I think that need for that support, that place to vent, with people who truly understand the deep feelings. To do it in partnership, of course, with Michael has been wonderful. In my family situation, there are things that aren't fair. Both my brothers are blind and are limited in what they can do. And that's not fair. It's not fair for them, and I can feel it's not fair for me because a lot of things they just can't do, and so it's me. But it is something I have chosen also. Michael and I came back from Nepal not only for our kids, but to know that we would at some point need to care for elderly parents, and we chose to do that. And so it is a choice that I find I continually need to keep making. I'll stop there, but yeah.
Not surprisingly, take a different tack. Well, and I'm primarily reflecting on what you shared, watching Dad's decline. So he died last year at 98. My mum died 13 to 14 years ago, at late 80s, and Dad was her carer. I'm conscious that the caring here is, for me, both my parents' deaths were good deaths. So that's where I'm coming from. They were deaths at the end of full lives. They were relatively painless deaths. And they were deaths where we had the chance to say our goodbyes well. So they weren't easy, and the caring wasn't easy, but there was a lot of grace we experienced in that for us. In the case of my dad, so again, we were living very close to him the last 5 years. So he was over the hill in East Perth, we were up the hill, he would walk up. Until the last 12, 18 months, he would walk up to us for dinner every Sunday night. And I had time with my dad that I would not have had if my mum was still alive, if that doesn't sound too terrible. And a lot of it was very precious. I think the whole journey with Dad was in frame quite intentionally for me. You know, I'm an intense, intentional person. Richard Rohr, James Hollis's language about the journey, the arc of life, the journey of the first and the second half of life having a natural momentum in it is a key frame for me, including my own. And so the journey with Dad at the end was very much me reflecting on my own trajectory. I'm 68 this year. Dad died at 98, 30 years age difference, but I'm not that far behind him. So, and I wrote a poem, Courage and Renewal poem, in my mid-50s called Becoming an Elder, the Child I've Always Been. So I was conscious even in my mid-50s that my energy is not the same as when I was 30 or 40. So I've been on that kind of arc in my own life. But the thing that my journey with Dad made me think about, watching... You saw him. You saw his decline. And so up until pretty much 12 months, he was living fully independently. Then there was this staggered drop in his cognitive and physical capacity. And then the last 3 months, when he was in Bethany, we would bring him on a Sunday morning. He was in major decline, but he was still there. And what I noticed almost entirely, and actually Lyndon's mum and my dad, and even Lyndon's dad in his vascular dementia, Lyndon's dad and my dad were examples of people declining and growing old graciously and gracefully. Lyndon's mum is the opposite, fighting it all the way, denying it all the way. I have a choice. I can't choose, I'm short of suicide and assisted dying. I don't get the choice about when I die or how I die. I, I'm working on, that I do have a choice about how well I die. That's what I'm very... And Dad, those last 12 months, Dad's, on the whole, gracious acceptance of his declining independence was just extraordinary. There were bolshy moments there, the conversations that we had, but basically he accepted his decline gracefully. And I want to be like that. That's what I'm thinking. And I read you, I'm not saying I'm going to be that good at it. I'm not claiming about that, but I'm clear about...
Can we all hold it to account?
Absolutely. But David White's a poem, I'm going to stop here. He's got a phrase that I'll end with. I'm loving this book. There's a new book of his poetry, David White is 66. Yeah, he's writing out of that place. This is called My Courageous Life. My courageous life wants to be my foundation, showing me day after day, even against my will, how to undo myself, how to surpass myself, how to laugh as I go in the face of danger, how to invite the right kind of perilous love, keep on learning, keep on letting go, how to find a way to die of generosity. That's my goal, is to be able to die of generosity and grace.
I'd really rather just sit and reflect on what Michael and Lyndon and Jenny have said, but just in case this is useful for anyone, I resonate to all of that. I've got notes. So my mum died about 8 years ago and my dad about 25 years ago. So I'm coming at this topic from a different place. And I'm a little bit younger than the others. I'm 59. So I refuse to think that I'm ageing at all. So my thoughts. I think a position of caring for friends or children or parents is just inherently likely to lead to feeling bad or guilty, because we never strike exactly the right balance, perhaps in retrospect or at the time. You could always do a bit more, and of course you can't always do a bit more, but it's hard to strike the perfect balance. I think caring's been more theorised in popular culture for parenting of children than it has for the elderly. That's my perception. So, you know, that we, when Becky was being brought up, didn't overdo it too much. And then there was a bit of a thought that we weren't doing enough, and that gave rise to helicopter parenting, where you just don't let your kid out of your sight for a moment. Oh, and when we were being brought up, we were back for meals. And then I've got friends who've discovered the idea of benign neglect, where, you know, it's actually good for kids to be given a bit of leeway. And then one person I know found a book about learning from failures, so decided to take benign neglect a bit further. And then when it spiralled into disaster, she took charge again. So, but we don't have that level of... I mean, it's evolving, and it's about an imperfect thing, about humans in relationship. We don't have that for the elderly, in my experience. I don't think we can know what's ahead either. With my mum, my dad's mum came and lived with us when I was little. She'd been shunted from sibling to sibling and ended up at dad's and mum's place in the end. And one of my sisters said that was... much older sister said that was when my mum stopped laughing a lot. So I think there's a lot of nostalgia about, you know, grandma in the corner in the rocking chair. So mum decided she wasn't going to impose on us. So she stayed resolutely at home, trying to learn from history and her experience. It would have been easier if she had imposed on us, because her not imposing meant going round to her place and doing everything, and that was difficult too. What I take from that is that every single situation is different, and it's very hard to learn from previous
events when new ones are different. So for me, when my mum was elderly, I was the club sandwich generation. I had a small child, a child in her late teens, early 20s, and an elderly mum. And they all wanted my complete focus. Now, that's no easier or harder than somebody who's alone with two elderly parents, an only child. You know, I had siblings, I had people everywhere, but it was still hard for me. Others, you know, who were alone, I know someone who had a nervous breakdown with two elderly parents in different nursing homes and a house full of all their stuff. So my conclusion from that, and also the other thing is you don't know what's coming. I was talking with a friend yesterday, the uniqueness of each situation, and she was saying her widowed father in his 80s has just proposed to the third person about 30 years younger. And that hadn't occurred to me. Every single thing is a first and we're not prepared for it. And it made me laugh. And then of course, because it resonated with my thought that you cannot prepare for these things because left field is enormous. And then I heard that she said, well, I'm glad you're laughing about it. It's been a nightmare for her. One of the people he proposed to was a vulnerable person and she had to intervene, but she's not inclined to, a traumatised person. Yeah, so that's a great difficulty for her. From my bird's eye view out of this phase of life, it was just another reminder that, you know, I might have my collection of wisdom from my experience, but it's no help to her at all. So I think, yeah, and this is where I think timeless things matter in this timeline. Things like, I've written in my notes here, yeah, an ordinary example of weight. You know, some people may be overweight for a long time and it's a terrible struggle. Some people may be underweight and it's a terrible struggle. You can't say to the other person, well, you're lucky, blah, blah, because a struggle's a struggle. And I think that's the same with, you know, whether you may end up with your parents on the other side of Australia or you may end up with them two blocks away. They're both a struggle. So I think it just gets back to love your neighbour, be kind and be respectful of other people's positions. If someone says they're struggling, they're struggling. And I think, yeah, there's a lot of different potential responses. There's either brace yourself or enjoy life as much as possible. And I don't think there's much point in bracing yourself because you just don't know what's coming. So one of my conclusions, it sounds really trivial, is make the most of the quiet times. We went to America within the last year of Mum's life. And that was sort of tricky because we, you know, you book holidays in advance and things weren't going so well. But that was great because I was really tired and that gave me strength the last few months. So, you know, good things are good things. It's always complex. What's next for me? Well, probably Peter's ageing. He's a little bit older than me, except he's retired and very well. So who knows? It might be mine. How can we prepare for that? Well, only with the inner work, with learning to be gracious with loss. But I think loss is tough. Loss of your own functions or witnessing the loss of someone else's functions is tough. Jesus wept. You know, that's real. I think God is with us through others' kind response to us when we feel bad. And I think that's pretty timeless.
One final thought from me, and then we won't break up into groups because it's you all got here late, you see. So anyway, the one thing that redeems Richard Foster for me is that he talks about the limits of submission. He says everything is complex. There isn't one way. And he said we need to both depend on the indwelling of the Holy Spirit to give us wisdom and strength, but we also need to support one another. And I think sometimes, you know, that is a role we can play for one another too, is to help one another recognise when we've reached a limit and to say, Rose, you need to go to America for a holiday, or, you know, and it's easy to say something to someone, but then to help make it happen, you know, those practical things. I'm good at the saying, not so good at the helping happen. So I'm going to open the floor. So we've got a few minutes, so Phil will come round.
I just have I have one thing I just feel, I'm feeling really strongly I need to say, and that is the choice not to care is actually can also be a really important step of spiritual growth, and the choice to actually end a relationship and not continue to participate in caring. I think we really need to validate that not everyone is going to be able to do that caring job, that it might need to happen, but it's not a good choice for them.
Yep.
And it actually is how they grow spiritually, by choosing not to do that caring.
Yep. And I think that's one of the things that Richard Foster talks about too, is that when is it damaging, and that you have to be able, and that's where we can help one another as well, I think, to recognise that, and it's part of the limits. Mm. Anyone else?
Yeah. When I was 35... I felt quite resentful that my mother was going through strokes and things like that, and I honestly felt that I shouldn't have to cope with that at my age, because she was 41 when I was born, and I thought I should be older before I have to cope with this sort of thing. Admittedly, she was on the other side of the country and my sister did more caring than I did. But then the problem was I didn't have my son till I was 39, so I've actually potentially given him the same problem. So it's like a generational thing, you know, it's self-repeating, that, you know, that you can end up with having elderly parents when you feel that you're still too young to face that kind of thing.
For Bevan and I, both, all our parents, all four of them, passed away long time ago. So we're in a position where there's just the two of us now, and I'm interested to know a little bit more about how we can support those who need the support now. Incidentally, we didn't care for any of our parents. We did visit Bevan's parents in a nursing home, but that was it.
It's probably time to see this as an ongoing conversation, and thank you very much for your careful listening, and thank you for those people who contributed. Yep, so over to you, Lee. Thanks.